Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Toonaries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Toonaries podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined as always by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
And we have a very special guest, Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee. How are you?
Hi, guys. How are things?
This is a long time coming.
It is.
When we started out over 3 years ago, one of the first emails we sent was to the Department of Justice, and we didn't get a reply. But we've a lot of contacts there now. So, we were meant to do this a good few months ago. But you were pregnant and you had the baby, and congratulations.
Thank you, yes. Yeah. It was all left a little bit tight to the wire, yeah. So unfortunately it didn't happen. But I've been looking forward to this, I have to say. Looking forward to having a chat.
I know it's great to have you here, and thanks to Emma and the rest for organising. Yeah. Very helpful. But before we get into the politics, do you want to explain to us where you're from, what it was like growing up for you, and maybe why you got into politics?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm from County Meath. I've lived there all my life. Grew up in a rural part called Castletown, so kind of North Meath. Very normal, I have to say, happy childhood. Myself, my younger sister, my older brother, my mum and dad. My dad, for the most part, probably till I was a teenager, 14 or 15, was a farmer. A lot of my uncles, my family, that would have been their background. But like a lot of people at that time, you either went bigger, you went out, and he decided to take a different route. So they bought a pub locally, and that was, I suppose, a big change. And we kind of got into it ourselves and would have gotten to know a lot of people around. It was in Nobber, D-Local, so still going. We don't have it ourselves, but it's still there. It's a great pub, but would have worked there. And I suppose my dad was always, he was always involved in something. So he trained football teams, I'd say 11 or 12 throughout kind of my lifetime anyway. He would have been involved in farming from that side, but he also would have repped and met people. So kind of always working in the community, but also involved in politics. So when he grew up, because my family and dad's side in particular would have been involved kind of locally, supporting candidates, all that kind of background stuff. So he would have always been involved. And it was kind of when I was maybe 17 or 18, when I was in college at that stage, he was asked to run for politics again and put himself forward, and I was kind of helped with campaigns and gotten involved at that stage. And just from then on, I mean, he was elected, he was a TD for years, he was a minister then, and I would have worked with him after that. I mean, I studied politics in college as well as part of my degree.
What was his ministry?
Agriculture. So,
Yeah, exactly.
So he knew exactly what it, you know, that's what he wanted, that's what he loved, and he was so good at it because it was kind of what he, like, he grew up, eat, breathing, sleeping agriculture. So, you know, if we went to a conference, he'd have been handed a speech from the officials and he'd have it rolled up in a bowl and he'd be using it to kind of bang the table, but he wouldn't actually be reading from it. Everything was kind of from his head. So he was so invested in it and so passionate about it. And I think because he always worked with people and was always kind of flying around trying to help people, it was a perfect fit for politics. I mean, that's what it is, that's what it always should be. So that's kind of where that side of it came for me, and where later on then obviously, you know, I made the decision to run, kind of having been working with him so closely and just seeing what he was doing and how important it was, you know.
Things like Young Fine Gael and things like that.
I was responsible. I don't know what year it was now. I'm thinking when I was in college for resetting up the branch in DCU. I would have been in DCU, so probably shouldn't have been as, or probably weren't as active as we should have been, but we would have had different talks. And I remember having Richard Bruton in for a chat at one stage, and you're just trying to get people interested and Freshers Week and getting people to join and all
is
that kind of crack.
The fella with the six pack,
he is indeed, yeah. He hid that back then. Now I don't
he's
know if he had one back
he?
Then
he's in savage shape, isn't he?
He, I think there were sharp intakes of breaths when they saw him coming out of the sea there. It was during COVID or around
That's right, yeah.
He keeps himself fit, definitely.
Yeah.
He's a great guy in general. He's a lovely guy, Richard, but yeah.
Was there any other interests for you or any fear of you going down a different career path, or was this all, was it?
No, it wasn't. I mean, when I was younger, I was always interested in law. I don't know why, it just kind of, it's something that interested me. So my degree was actually economics, politics and law. I never really liked the economic side of things. That wouldn't have been my strongest, you know, when I was in school, I was always better at English. I was always better at art. I was always kind of a different side than the mathematical side or the business side. But funnily enough, when I came out of college, I started working in a bank. So I went the complete opposite direction and decided that I wasn't necessarily as keen on, but you know, that lasted for about a year. It just wasn't for me, and I just kind of knew it wasn't the direction that I wanted to go in. So I went back, I did more study, I was kind of did a master's in journalism and media communications, and then I kind of started working in politics at that stage. So I had a kind of a varied kind of background, and I took time out. I took a year out. I worked away. I worked in bars. I did different things and just kind of decided, right, what do I actually want to do? It's like a lot of young people. You kind of you come straight out of college. You're offered the first job. You take it. You think this is money. This is great. I'm starting a job, and then you kind of go, okay, well, actually, what do I want
to
do? And
that's
not necessarily
stuff really stands to people, though, doesn't it? You have to go out there and experience the world first before you jump right into the job. And you're going down this route, you know, in politics, and you've no real life experiences before that. Say, for example, working in a bar, inside a bank, that has shown you what people are like, really.
Yeah.
You know, instead of going in and what they need and what they want.
Yeah.
So it gives you great life experience. My own daughter, George, is taking a year out before she goes to college, and
what's she doing or what does she want to do?
What are we going to do? Leave her off.
Yeah.
Leave her off, leave her mature in the year, and leave her see what she really wants to do. And she wants to go down the route of psychology herself, and I said, leave her off. She's responsible enough to know what she wants, and just leave them off. But she wants to go down that way, and she'll learn a lot in that year, and it'll get her ready then for the following year if she wants to go back to college. So it's a great thing to do, really, isn't it?
There's a lot of pressure on people. You kind of, like, you finish school at 18, and it's like, right, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? It's just some people know, and that's great, and some people are absolutely, you know, this is what I want to be, and they try it and it's not what they want either. But, you know, I don't think you should ever kind of stop people from having that break, or, you know, and not everyone can do it. I was lucky that, you know, I had parents who supported me to go back into college, and I fully acknowledge, you know, I had that support and that help there. But at the same time, you know, you need to kind of be able to carve your own path as well and decide what's best for you.
It sounds like your father had a big impact on your life, but there was a tragedy there as well.
Yeah, I mean, oh look, he it's hard to kind of describe who he was or what he was like. He was absolutely amazing, and as I said, I had a fantastic, this happens sometimes, it happens, it doesn't happen other times, you know. No, I don't need a tissue. No,
yeah, I lost my mother probably the same way,
to suicide.
Yeah,
it's like, and every situation is different, and that's the thing. Every scenario, and I mean, I've worked in the Department of Health where I was Minister for Mental Health, and you're trying to kind of talk about it as though, not trying to, but sometimes people assume that you're talking about it as though everybody's the same and there's this one approach for everybody, or that, you know, with Dad, it was very different in that for us, like, he never had mental health problems that we were aware of, my mum, that any, you know, that we ever saw growing up. It wasn't that this was kind of something that was expected. It was like,
he was probably an old school man, that they kind of retained all their emotional stuff and never spoke about their feelings.
I don't know, because he was a big softie. Like, he was such a softie. Like, I remember, it was probably only a few weeks before he died. I think mum was away, and there was probably a lot going on or something, and I came home and I just gave him a big hug. Do you know the way sometimes, yeah. And I think it was a day or two afterwards, he was like, oh, you know, I needed that hug, you know, just yeah. like he'd talk. He was always someone who talked. So I don't think it was necessarily that he built everything up, but yeah. I think he was under a lot of pressure. I think he was minister at the time, and the job that he did, he never kind of gave it 100%. It was 120. If somebody needed yeah. to talk to him, he'd get in the car at 10 o'clock at night and drive to them. And there was a lot going on at the time. And he was kind of, he's like we all are, but probably more so. He kind of spent his life on the road, kind of moving around and trying to respond to things. And if he didn't get something done for someone, he'd take it quite personally. And I suppose that time as well, it was 2012, like we'd had the crash. Yeah. We were in government, he was in government, and the decisions that he and his colleagues had to make, it wasn't how much money, it was where are we cutting? It was cutting into services, it was everything. Absolutely everybody was being cut, and I think...
And that was probably against his grain.
Oh, look, you have people ringing with children with disabilities, and he would ring every single one of them back. And I think, to be honest, it's just a lot of pressure kind of and things built up. I don't think it's that something, you know, that I ever know if that something wasn't dealt with previously. I just think sometimes things can happen, and it's like yeah. your physical health, something can come upon very quickly and it's not, you know, it's not something you're expecting, and you know, look, that we kind of, you have to deal with this and you have to move on, and you have
it can
to
happen to anybody, like,
exactly,
you never know, like you never know what's coming down the line for you and your family. And that's what you have yeah. to value today and what you have today.
Yeah.
Because it can all change down the line. Circumstances can change. You could lose your job. Your company that you're working for could go into liquidation. Your child could be in an act. You don't know what's yeah. going to happen and the pressures that will bring you. So yeah. we can't look at anybody with judgment or anything like that. And we just have to, I suppose, value the moment we have, because that's all you have at the end of the day.
Yeah. And it's a cliche, but it's the best. Like, it's so true. You have to just, you know, and yourselves, or if you're under pressure, or if yeah. I'm under pressure in work, you can get so caught up in things in your head. You know, my husband's great at Paul saying, stop for a minute. Everybody, you know, the world isn't against you. Stand and talk to a few people and you'll yeah. soon realise that, yeah. you know, everybody has their own life and they're doing their own thing, and, you know, just take a step back.
We can, like, in what we all do here, you can try to help everyone and be everybody's friend and do the right thing for everybody. It doesn't work like that.
No.
You know, some people are going to love you, some people are going to like you, some people are going to hate you.
Going to hate you, and that's yeah. all right too.
And I've gotten that myself, you know, in the last few years, we're 3.5 years around doing this, and I've gotten a lot of negative shit too.
Do you get a lot of pushback just to yourself?
Like, because of my background, you know, yeah. where, yeah. And that's okay, you know.
But like, you see, people want to put you in a box
yeah.
where people like things that simple. Right, we were talking before, people like a focal point and they like to simplify things. Everything is black and white. They committed crime, they have a shady past, they should not be allowed to move on with their lives, they shouldn't be allowed to have a podcast, they shouldn't be allowed to, you know, that's what some people, very small, now I must say, if we get 1,000 comments, there might be 2 bad.
Yeah.
That's yeah. genuinely.
But is it the 2 bad that you fix on, or do yeah. you, can yeah. you,
that's the thing.
That's
you
the problem.
You can focus yeah. on those, yeah. you know, and what I've realised in recovery, I've allowed myself to be able to process stuff when it comes up. For example, I would be quite sensitive, right? But I became strong around this stuff in a way that at the beginning when I used to get it and somebody would say this or that and the other, whatever, I would go so much into myself in
yeah.
fear. I'd have this overwhelming, strong feeling in here. And it would like bringing back these core beliefs that I had from childhood, that I was worthless and I was no good and you're bad, you know. And instead of arguing with that voice in my head, I started to just sit with the way I was feeling and allow that voice. Like, I knew the reality of it is I'm a good person, I do the right thing. But I knew the reality of it, that it wasn't like that. And as every single time that kept happening to me, I would keep going back and processing. I know when stuff comes up, it is what it is.
Yeah, but there was a reason.
I can't control it. I leave yeah. people off. So
and there was a reason.
It takes time to get
yeah.
to that point.
It do,
yeah.
but
yeah.
there was something happened there recently enough on social media, but it was my wife was involved in this comment, and it was very nasty. And that really kind of hit me a little bit, because we get it. That's fair enough. When you're in the public eye, it's parcel of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when your family is brought into it, it hits a little bit differently. Have you ever been in that situation where you feel like I know some people's houses have been marched upon by people in government, not ministers and TDs, the houses. Sometimes people cross the line, you know?
They do, and I mean, your family, while you obviously want them to be supportive, I mean, I couldn't do the job I do without my husband and to be honest, my wider family being as supportive as they are. But it's hard when it crosses the line. I mean, I'd see comments about dad and different things, which really, you know, you're angry because some of them can be very nasty and pointed, and even around his death and all, you know, really horrible things that nobody would ever say to anyone's face, which is kind of, to be honest, what I then kind of think, well, because I've often gone back to people where they've raised criticism to where they might have said things, you know, happy to sit down and talk to you, and it's a blank. So when, you know, you'd kind of think, do you know what, that's not really, there's no point in responding to something that isn't a constructive criticism. But in terms of family, I mean, look, my husband is often brought into things, and my children as well. And you do have to kind of decide you're just going to rise above it. And, you know, if it ever went to a certain point or too far, then I'd respond. But it hasn't ever. But you do sometimes just have to rise above it, and it angers them and it upsets people. But, you know,
it does show a lack of awareness as well from some people's behalf, because they'll be bringing people into the context of something like that because they're not happy with something you're doing, and they're bringing in loved ones. Like, we would never do it normal. People who understand how it works would never do that, because we know that's the wrong thing to do. You know, we know it. This has nothing to do with a family. It might be your disagreement in something, in a policy or something that's being done in the government or whatever, but you don't go ahead and start attacking someone's family, you know. But I know that's the wrong thing for someone to do, so when it happens, oh, yes. Like, what the fuck, like? You just kind of brush it off, you say, right, like, just, you know, and leave it off. I don't give it any more energy then. I don't think about it, don't talk about it, and just leave it off.
But nobody that sets up a fake profile, and with all that negativity, they're not in a good place themselves. Because if you're in a good place in your life, and you're kind of content, and you're getting on with your life, you're not going to do something like that. So if you see something like that, you would think, like, at least I'm not there. Do you know what I mean? At least I'm well enough of myself where I don't feel the need to take people down a notch. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because it's an insecurity that people have as well.
Yeah, and look, I mean, like, even for my own work, like, social media is fantastic. It means I can communicate with people in ways, you know, I talked to colleagues who would have been there 20, 30 years ago, and they would have gotten a letter from someone. They wrote the letter, they replied. It took a couple of weeks. Like, it's instant now. You can respond to someone. If someone has a really urgent problem, you can have it dealt with or help to resolve it in a few hours, whereas you couldn't do that before, and it's great. But, you know, there's downsides to it as well. People can say whatever they want, you know, within reason. You know, obviously we've seen recently where people have gone too far and they've made threats and they've harassed people, and you can actually take a course of action, and things have gone to the courts and all of that. But, like, you don't ever want to kind of get to that stage, or it shouldn't ever. But There's a balance there, you know, and it's kind of sometimes teetering on the edge of not being helpful, but, you know, there's good ways of using it as well.
There is, So let's talk about crime and justice, will we?
Yeah.
So the Irish Prison Service is at the capacity at the moment, in terms of numbers and prisons and stuff like that. The Circle Courts will be up and running there now, September, October. There'll be a lot of cases that were adjourned during COVID that are coming up. There's a huge amount of cases pending, and there's nowhere to put people. Now, in Spain, you wouldn't go into custody for under 24-month sentences. And I'm not saying we should do that, but do you ever envisage Ireland going down the route of, like, for short sentences like that, prison, that has to be the last option, because just for the obvious reasons, the logistics of housing people like that, plus even if you had the space for them, it's not good for them to get into that revolving door, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, you've touched on a few things. So, I mean, look, there's a space issue at the moment, and with the growing population, you have to look at that on one side of things as well, and, you know, providing more capacity. And as you said, there's a huge amount of backlog. We've added additional judges. You're going to have a lot more people coming through the courts quicker, but there's a balance to be struck, and I agree with you, and there's a lot of work we're doing at the moment. We had a massive review looking at prison options, and then looking at penal policy and where we can reform it. So in particular, one of the biggest parts of that review was looking at shorter sentences, looking at where people get 3 months or less, looking at 12 months, and what actually would be more beneficial. Because, like there is that balance where somebody commits a crime, where you have a victim, you know, where you need to have a sentence or you need to have an appropriate punishment, or like you need, you know, there needs to be justice for somebody if there's a victim there. At the same time, if you have somebody where there's addiction problems, where there's mental health problems, issues, or even, you know, if it's a short sentence and that sentence means they might lose their apartment, they might lose their job, they might lose the people who are close to them who decide, do you know what, children, I'm not helping
children
them.
Children going into care and stuff.
Children
like that.
Going into care, like, is it better for somebody to go in for a short stay where they can't get the long-term educational programs that often help to turn people
the psychology
around?
Psychology services and stuff.
All
like
of
that.
These services, it's short-term, or do you put something else in place? And I suppose the problem we have in recent times is that we don't have enough of the other things for people to do. So there's a number of kind of strands, and we're kind of at the stage where all of it is coming together. So you had work being done with the district court looking at I suppose previous acts which dealt with community service. You have the probation have done their own piece of work. You have community sanctions being looked at to see what more can be done, how effective are they at the moment, how well are they used, what do judges think of them, how much and how often do they use them, to see then how can we kind of put a plan in place moving forward. And my own view on this is there's no point in changing the law and saying you have to do this if we don't actually have the people and the plans and the options in place, because you can put it in writing, but you have to follow through with the with supports and resources and people and boots on the ground and all of that. So, I mean, look, we've budgets coming up again, and for the last few years, we've tried to, well, we have invested in the probation service, we've invested in the different programmes that are there to work with people. So, working for change or working to change is one in particular, which is, you know, looking at working with people who want to find work after they come out of prison. But I mean, you mentioned mental health. We have a task force that Kathleen Lynch, who's from down this neck of the woods,
she's
shared.
From the north side. Where
she
we're
is,
from.
And she had obviously been in mental health. She was senior minister when I was junior minister for a certain period of time. So she chaired a task force looking at mental health in prisons.
She did.
The supports, the resources that are there, but more importantly, when people get out as well, what's there to help people and that kind of revolving door.
Yeah,
problem.
It was a good report, and I was at a kind of a launch of it in UCC with all the people involved. But the only thing is stuff like that, and is that can't just sit somewhere gathering dust, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The implementation of that is very important, because there was very good recommendations in that report.
Yeah.
Like, what's the process of implementation? Who pays for it? And, like, is there a kind of a broad or government strategy around crime? Because a lot of the time the Department of Justice is has to address the symptoms of wider issues.
Yeah.
For example, where we're from in the north side here, there's a before fives early intervention. It's a creche, preschool, play therapy, stuff like that. I would have went to it as a kid 30 odd years ago. Timmy, I've a niece that goes there for play therapy. It's a big part of the community. It's there over 50 years. And that was closing down, but it's actually staying up now because of people power.
Okay.
But I suppose the point I'm making is there's no use in opening prisons if we're closing childcare facilities, you know, because they are the people, like, it's the early intervention. We all know early intervention is important. But do you ever have conversations with Roderick O'Gorman or whoever else around, like, we need to invest in early intervention to reduce crime? It's not just about the justice problem.
Yeah. I do, and we do, and we've a number of different areas, even where I would be kind of working on a cross departmental and cross basis with colleagues, and it's something we weren't always good at. You know, you're in your own department, your own budget, your own objectives and your own goals, and then suddenly you're crossing over and you're potentially sharing budgets, or you're crossing over, and like, it's not always the way it worked, but I think we're getting much better just generally across government and agencies and departments in working better together. And I mean, the mental health task force, so that's not just the Department of Justice, it's the prison service, it's the probation service, it's the HSE, it's health. So the actions that come from it, there's a group, an implementation group essentially, that's there now to drive change on it. And so it's about putting the resources in. So where there's health actions, it's making sure that when it comes to the budget that they have an ask in for the different actions. The same with us working with the probation service, the prison service. So there's a plan there. So that's something I was really keen on, that it wasn't a report that just sat on a shelf and wasn't actually followed through on. So there's there's a number of the different pilot programs, there's a number of different areas that are being developed already. But like, you do have to buy in for every from everybody to have it work. Like, none of these things work if it's only been driven by one department or one minister or one agency or anything like that. Like, I mean, the prison education task force that's working away at the moment. It's going well. You're on that, and you can see that, it's and that's bringing together higher education with the Department of Justice and the Prison Service and others, and that's kind of new, that kind of way of engagement, which is good.
Just to add to that, myself and James, we're doing a number of different things with the prisons, the IPS at the moment, and some of it is absolutely tremendous. Karen now and Emma and Fergal, he's gone now, but the work that they're doing, I see some massive changes in different areas. James is on a few task forces, I am, and we're trying to get these different things off the ground in relation to rehabilitation for prisoners, more education. That task force will be a mighty thing, where you're getting giving fellas practical skills for when they get out, so they're actually employable the minute they leave the gate, and maybe there's an employer waiting to take them on board, because we'll have employers that are interacting with the IPS, and we're getting people ready for when they go out, they step into a job on a Monday morning. That's the kind of stuff that will keep people away from drugs and the life of crime, because they're not sitting at home in boredom you know, anymore, because now they're employable, because their employer knows where they're after coming from. There's no issue with the Garda vetting process, and they're in here and they're actually showing this employer what they're capable of doing, that they can be trusted, they can be responsible, and they're actually somebody who really, really works hard and is always punctual. So these are the things that are changing. And even around rehabilitation, I know the services aren't there at the moment, but bringing people in with lived experience into prisons, that's a
makes a big difference.
Big deal.
You have to think outside of the box, because recruitment is a huge issue across all sectors at the moment. Housing, it goes back to housing, unfortunately, because if you're trying to recruit in Cork City or in Galway City or Limerick City or Dublin City, like, people are looking at the job, they're looking at the location of the job and how they actually live in that area if that rent is unaffordable or they can't afford a home. So it's good that there's cross-departmental stuff happening. But some of the stuff Timmy's talking about there, is there a risk for you being a Fine Gael and, you know, traditionally known as the Law and Order Party, that some of maybe your more mature voters might see as soft if you're doing this, if you have these progressive policies? Because it's not, you're not soft on crime, it's actually smart on crime. Because if when somebody goes into prison, what do we want? We want that person to stop committing crime. But you can't just tell them stop committing crime. You have to rehabilitate them and provide opportunities in education and climate.
And there's always a balance. And it's funny, I mean, it's whether it's the older members or whoever it is I'm talking to, I think people really do see that you can either try and get to the root cause of what's going on here and stop the revolving door, or we can just keep doing the same of what we've been doing and it doesn't actually change things. Now, there's always the balance that, you know, if somebody is a victim of a crime, they expect that there's going to be, you know, punishment for the person at the other end who's done it. But at the same time, like, you have to look at what else can we be doing to try and rehabilitate.
Everybody has a release
somebody. Everybody, you know, and sometimes it takes a lot of times, it takes a lot of engagement. You know, I was saying to you earlier, I was in with the Alliance here in Cork, and some of the lads that I met with, I mean, it took years and a huge amount of engagement from the team there. You know, I was up with a group in Dublin recently who deals specifically with younger people, and while the youth diversion programmes that we have are fantastic, and I suppose they reach young people at a certain stage before they get into to crime and serious crime, this project in particular is working with young people where they've gone way past that threshold and where they're, I suppose, caught in this cycle. But it's kind of that never give up attitude. You need to keep working with them, you need to keep going back, even if they don't want you there, you have to keep trying to help, and you won't get everybody who wants to come on board, but you do make a difference. And that is so beneficial to everybody. And, you know, like, there is this perception, Fine Gael, law and order, and it's all lock them up and more prisons and tougher policies. And sometimes you do need stronger sentences, or you do need kind of to be firm, but you also need to look at, well, what's actually going to make a difference? What actually benefits people in the long run? And, you know, if it's other options other than prison, like, if that's actually going to help other people in the community, then why wouldn't we look at that? So it's all coming together. And I, you know, I'm meeting my colleagues this weekend. We were a few days we go off and think and plan really for the next session and the next all term. And I'll be talking to them about what I'm doing. And this is part of it, looking at new options, new policies, and a big one actually. And it kind of touches on what you're saying, people working together. So you'll probably know, or, you know, if things happen, the first go-to is the guards. Where are they? What are they doing? We need more of them. And that's really important. That's part of responding to crime or, you know, social issues. But sometimes the burden falls solely on their shoulders for a lot of things. So we've a new policy that we're implementing at the moment. It's not a policy. It's a new way that we're going to kind of move things forward, where instead of having joint policing committees where you have the guards talk to local elected representatives and they kind of discuss what's going on, you're actually bringing together police, the local authorities, elected representatives, education providers, health providers, TUSLA, HSE, all of these people, and that they, with members of the community, draw up a plan and say, right, what's going on in our area? What do we need more of? What are the issues? What do we need to address? And then everybody has to play a part. So it's not just the guards, it's the education providers, it's all the services.
It's like the conference that you spoke at and then we spoke at up in Dundalk that time.
That's exactly what it is, that's the community safety partnership. Yeah.
So that's working really well.
We just launched the Dublin plan, the inner city plan, on Friday.
Is that national eventually?
Eventually. So we have three pilots and we're kind of assessing them at the moment. And there's a lot really good things happening. There's things that can be tweaked, and I suppose that's why we did the pilots first. But the plan is to have them all rolled out and that everybody would start that next year. And I mean, you saw from being in the room yourselves, like, if you want to address a lot of these issues, you need people talking together. You need everybody around the table. I'm a big fan of saying, like, if you want to address anything, you have to be around the table, everyone looking at each other and everyone saying, right, I'm going to do my bit, you do yours. And then it all comes back
together. For the right reason. Everybody's there for the right reason and they're willing to work with every person at the table. Yeah. And that's how it works. Instead of one organisation doing their thing and they won't interact with this one because they don't believe it's about everybody interacting together for the bigger picture.
Yeah, and it actually benefits. So if you think it's nothing to do with you, you realise by actually doing all of this together, it benefits what you're doing. So if you're in the health service, it'll actually help you in the job that you're trying to do. If you're working with schools, it'll actually help you in attendance or whatever, you know, putting all these other matters together. So
it's like something that happened in our community that we lived in. Well, we were brought up in a number of estates, but in each estate you had maybe four or five entrances into the estate, right? All like the antisocial behaviour,
nightmare to police behavior.
There's one entrance and one exit. There is not one bit of antisocial behaviour inside.
Because everyone knows where you go in and go out, and that's
But these practical things you do.
Yeah. People came together and thought about it.
So these are the things that need to be done in communities, right? Yeah. What if we block off this area and leave the residents come in this way? It'll stop all the antisocial behaviour, the drug dealing in corners and all the bikes and all the other things that go with that. Being inside in this estate where people, 99% of the people, just want to get on with their lives and live a normal life, and it stops. And what that initiative that you're on about there is something that they will be talking about. Yeah. How can we resolve these issues here with the antisocial behavior?
There was one specific piece in that stood out for me. It was cute, no, but it was very good as well on a deeper level. But in this area, I think it was in Drada actually, or in Loud somewhere. But it was like, if not, if you caught speeding in this area, you had to sit before judges, but the judges were children, right? And they had to question you about why you were speeding. How would you feel if I was crossing the road and you hit me, you know? But it was like, that was a real consequence, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you can pay your fine and get your penalty points, but you don't want to sit across from three children grilling you about what could have happened. But even, like, from the children's perspective...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You're fostering a sense of active citizenship in there that my voice is heard and I can actually participate in justice here, you know, and they're the leaders that in 10, 15, 20 years' time, it's going to be, you know, common practice for them that it's not just the guards, we can actually participate in justice too.
Yeah, and it makes it real when something like that happens. Yeah. Like what we're asking people to do is to, and we set up a fund that's taking money from CAB essentially, where it's been obviously taken off criminals, and we've set up a new fund and asked people to come up with new and imaginative ways that you can help keep your community safe. And it's those kind of, you know, I suppose that's a, I'm not sure what you've got, you know, that's an initiative, and it's
just a bit of creativity, like.
Bit of creativity, but it really, I'm sure, you know, I wouldn't like to sit in front of a kid saying, well, what if I was crossing the road, and you're thinking, oh my God, what have I done? Like,
but you'll think twice the next time.
You would, and it's how do you replicate those type of things that really make it real for people, but that change people's behaviour, because everything that you're doing, it's about trying to change people's behaviour, and often it's bringing it back and pairing it back and making it real for people that's but also, you know, as you said yourselves, it's talking to people on a human level, engaging with them and looking at, well, what maybe is going on here, what's the real reason behind these actions, and how can we kind of get to the bottom of that, and there's nothing soft about that, that's actually changing behaviours, and that's what everybody wants, you know.
Even saying, even our prisons, there's a lot of people in prison today, and I'd say maybe 60-70% of them that may have addictions, and they don't know nothing about addiction. They know nothing about addiction. They don't know why they're using drugs to be able to soothe themselves. They haven't a clue. They don't even realise the trauma that they suffered as a child is one of the contributes to why they're actually caught up in addiction and they have poor mental health. But when you start educating people around these different things, you start turning on light bulbs in their heads. And that's when the option of recovery starts to become bigger for them, you know, because they now know that the addiction is there to help them to keep away from all the trauma that's bottled up. You know, I think programs like that, and I'm sure there are some at the moment, you know, within the prisons, like, but these are the kind of things that we need in there, just inform people that you were never born to be a bad human being. That was never God's plan for you. You were brought up into an environment that was really, really difficult, and you had to cope in whatever way you had to, because there was violence there, there was drugs, there was abuse of all forms, you know, and you probably had to shut off from a young age emotionally to be able to cope in that context and that environment, you know. And what happens then is that child goes into their head and they become an extrovert, completely introverted, you know, and it's all about the mind. And then they might have these core beliefs that they're no good, they're bad, they're ticked because they can't be educated in school because they're disruptive. You know, we need to start explaining these things in our prisons, because 80% of prisoners, like, might have a different learning difference, because if they've never went to school as a child, it might be ADHD, some of them might be on this spectrum of autism, and they're just left there. You know, they're just, after getting out of prison, I was diagnosed with dyslexia, ADHD. You know, I know for a fact my brothers are the same. You know, and these lads are in there, they're sitting there, and they just haven't a clue. And I'm not here standing up for everybody inside in the prison. Oh. All I'm trying to do is give some of the facts that I know about from my own experience. I will never, ever justify anybody's actions while they're in prison, because there's always a victim, and I don't believe, because I've been a victim, and there are victims of mine as well, and I'll be saying my sorries and paying my respects to that for the rest of my life, you know, by doing what I'm doing today with James and other stuff. You know, it's just we need to start opening up people's eyes, explaining to people that everybody, they're not bad, the people on the streets or the drug addicts, they're not bad. You have to understand what they're going through.
Yeah, because we're in prisons regularly, and like when you meet some of the people in there, and then you'll be thinking like, they have so much potential. Yeah. You know, like I can't understand how they're in here when they seem like a regular person. Yeah. Me or you. But when you look into the background and you hear about things that they've experienced, it's not, you can't absolve them of any responsibility because they still did what they did, and there still needs to be justice, and they still have to serve their time. But they're not a write-off, and there is potential there as well.
The Toon Arries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
And that's, I think, where the younger side, like, that's where trying to catch people when they're younger before it gets to that stage, before it gets to the point where you're in prison, and whether it's through schools, whether it's the diversion programs, whether it's looking at new and different ways, or, you know, in dealing with drugs, that you're looking at it from a health perspective. I mean, that's why we have a minister now, where their sole focus is on drugs community, but leading at it from a health perspective to see, well, how can we deal with addiction? How can we respond in that sort of a way, instead of seeing everybody as a criminal and everybody as, you know, putting everybody in the one box. And you're right, I mean, you have to balance that with the fact that someone's in prison for a reason, but you have to try and put the supports and the resources in place to help people change, to help address what they've gone through. And some people have gone through, you know, unimaginable.
A lot of them are victims
challenges
themselves, you see, and they're just carrying the cycle of it. But can I talk to you about the guards? Because there's a lot of negativity going on. We spoke at a conference in Galway a couple of months ago. Usually when we speak at conferences, it's all very cordial and everybody says, oh, we're all doing great work and stuff like that. But this was the Garda Sergeants and Inspectors conference in Galway. Okay. We presented to them. Went great. Don't get me wrong, went great. So we stayed on for a while after Drew Harris came in, right? And I wasn't prepared for, like, it was very adversarial. It was like, the rep of the union spoke about the issues from the guards. Then Drew Harris came up and kind of rebutted some of that stuff. And it was like, no, it was very respectful, don't get me wrong. But there was tensions there. Now, there's an escalation in those tensions with a vote of no confidence. And are you concerned about this whole situation? And what's the story with not being able to recruit guards, not being able to retain guards? Have you any opinion as to why we're in the situation we are?
Well, you'll always have a bit of tension kind of between the boss and the unions. And, like, you know, I've been at two conferences in the last week. I was at the Chief Supers last week. I was at the Supers yesterday. And, I mean, you know, their president will stand up and he'll say, well, we want this and this and we're not happy with this. And that's fine. And I'm able to stand up and say, well, that's fine. And I'm going to do more on this and I'm already doing this. And you have that, you know, that's kind of what you have as part of any organisation. And I mean, look, I do think that what's happened at the moment, you work through it. And I'm saying this for the last couple of months, like, it's like anything, you sit around the table and you talk through what the issues are. And there's, you know, there's issues that the guards have raised. And, you know, roster's been one of them, but recruitment, as you said, is another. Like, we don't have enough of them. They're brilliant. They do amazing work, but they're under huge pressure and they don't have enough colleagues to help them kind of spread the load. The biggest problem there really is that we had a recruitment campaign and we had numbers coming through the college at a great rate and it was flying. And then COVID hit and the whole thing just stopped. And it's kind of like a production line, you know, it stops. To get it going again, it's just taken a bit of time. You have to do your campaigns, you have to get people in, you have to go through processes and interviews and back and forth and everything. So it's just, it's taken a lot longer. And we're kind of at the stage now where that kind of mechanism is back up and running and the bigger numbers are coming in now. But we've just lost a lot of ground and it's really frustrating for people. Like I'm in Garda stations nearly every week and I'm kind of talking to people and just, you know, I try not to run in and out. I give it as much time and what's going on, what can I do, what's happening. Just people are you know, they're stretched and they need more colleagues. So that's, you know, that'll take a bit of time, and we're kind of heading in that right direction.
Would a vote of no confidence from rank and file Gardaí towards the commissioner, like, where does that leave his position? Do you know, like, do you think that it's salvageable, that we could still work forward, or do you think that change might happen? Maybe you can't answer that question.
No, I mean, the commissioner's not going anywhere, and, you know, he's very professional in his job, and, you know, the unions and the GRA in particular have said that this is about certain issues that they want resolved. You know, the only way you resolve issues, it's not by changing the person that's there, because this is a whole team of people at senior management that have to work through and, you know, have to work with me, and we have to kind of do what we can to try and resolve some of the issues. But that's how you kind of resolve it. And I don't think they're calling for him to change. Yeah. It's what they're saying is, look, we have issues, we want to resolve them.
Yeah.
I don't think personalising it was the right thing to do, to be honest. Yeah. I think he's a professional and he always approaches his job with the view that I want to do what's best for the people that I'm here to serve and the country, but also the people that I work with, and that's the guards. And I really do think that's the approach he's always taken. But, you know, you see this in education, you see it in health. Yeah. It's not the first time that unions have had a disagreement with their association, and the way it's resolved is people sitting around the table. And, you know, I think that'll happen. That's kind of the route that should be taken.
Yeah, so we're in a moment in time where there's issues and hopefully they can be resolved amicably. Yeah. But,
a couple of things have all come together at once, and like that, it creates a perfect storm. And you're just, you know, we're kind of getting to a point where we can resolve a number of them.
Do you know what
that'll
like,
help?
It's like a business, a startup business starts off, right? And everybody knows a business loses money. Not all business in the first year, but you're going to come across difficult times, you know. But you have to keep going.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. It's like this. It's like the same thing is happening. The guards. It's like they're coming across these really difficult problems within the guards at the moment, and they're willing to just throw the man at the top out or whatever. But it's like you have to kind of keep going, because the turning point is just probably around the corner and things will change. You know, imagine bringing somebody else in there and the same issues are going to be there that he's having, and you're going to be, it'll take more time for them to step into that position than to get used to it and to be familiar with the people there and just make some changes that are going to last. It's like, give people an opportunity. Nothing really, really gets done in this country quick anyway. Let's look at
everything
it.
Everything always takes a little bit longer than you'd like. Yeah, unfortunately. But I think I think what's there is manageable. It's salvageable. You know, it's workable, and I think we will.
A couple of last year, we got an award at the Law Society of Ireland, Media Award, for a podcast we did with our friend Darren O'Mahony.
Congratulations!
On domestic violence, but you've done a good bit of work in that area as well. Do you want to bring us up to speed with some of the reforms or changes in that area?
Yeah, God, there's so much needs to be done in that area. Like there's a lot we're doing, but it's such an unbelievably big problem. I just, the longer I'm in this department and in this role, the more people I engage with and the more you see how prevalent it is, be it domestic violence, be it issues at home, or just, you know, recent surveys where 1 in 4 women have said they've been raped or assaulted. Like, you know, I'm thinking of myself and the group of friends that I have. That's one of us. You know, it's kind of scary, but, you know, we're talking about it more, we're focused on it more, and it's a matter of kind of keeping that sustained focus on. I mean, one of the first things I did when I came into the department, there was a report done looking at the court system and kind of what victims go through just trying to even get to court and when they're in court. And to be honest, people don't come forward because it's just not easy. It's not inviting, it's not warm, it's not welcoming for anyone. So we put a lot of focus on this report, and straight away, to your point about this report on the shelf, there was an implementation plan in a couple of weeks, and it was, right, how do we get working on all of these as soon as possible? So because of that, you have every division in the country, and the guards have a Division Protective Service unit. So that's a unit that deals specifically with sexual violence, assault, rape, domestic violence in some instances. You have
Would the revenge porn be part of that then? What's going on?
It could be, depending on the units and who's dealing with it. But the COCO's law piece, which we passed, so the sharing of intimate images, that might be the regular guards in the station, or depending on what it is, it could be transferred over to the divisional units. But that, I mean, to be honest, like, you kind of know those issues are there, particularly with the fact that young people are online all day, every day. Yeah. But like since it's been passed, which is 3 years coming up now this Christmas, like the amount of people that have come forward to hotline to say that they've been victims where somebody has shared an intimate image of them without their permission, that it's been spread around school, that there's something up that has been doctored that isn't them, that they're being harassed. Like there's been a huge amount of people have come forward. But most importantly, there's been huge success in getting them taken down because of the new law, but also actual prosecutions. So not everyone will want to go to the guards or they'll want to kind of take it further, but people are now more confident to go to the guards. And we have new campaigns that are happening at the moment saying it's not just sharing it, it's actually threatening to share it. So all of these things.
Even just having it in your person.
Just having it and threatening and saying, well, if you don't do this, like that's, you know, it's crazy to think. Like you have really young people that are in this situation and, you know, people communicate differently and in your relationships they communicate differently now as well. But things go wrong and, you know, they go wrong when you're 14, 15, relationships don't often last.
And mental health then, because you're not really able to process something like that when it happens at that age because you're young, you're a teenager trying to cope with teenage years, then for something like that to happen. But when I seen one of the first ads coming out, I said, Jesus Christ, it's about time. You know, something like this needs to happen. But also, I also believe what needs to happen is maybe guards going into fifth and sixth years into the, and explaining what this new law, these new laws are.
Yeah.
You know, because it's when it's explained by a guard in the classroom and listen, lads, if you do this or ladies, if you do this, share pictures, you could possibly go to prison.
Yeah, and that's happening, I suppose, separate to the guards, which is great. There's because more of an awareness because of that.
Yeah, the opposite side of that. Is someone's mental health really deteriorating over some a picture that somebody else has in their phone, or maybe a suicide attempt? And I know there probably are children who have probably attempted suicide over stuff like this, you know. So I think it's really something that is very beneficial at the moment, and getting something like that out there and actually prosecuting people that actually act on it, you know, because. I have young kids myself, and I wouldn't know what I'd think or be able to do if something like that happened to one of them.
No, and I'm terrified. Yeah. My boys are only two and a half and 9 months, but I'm just thinking, what will they have to deal with? How will they deal with things online when they get older? Like, and I'm way away, so God only knows what they'll be doing, like in 15, 16 years time. But like, it's like, I mean, Coco's Law. That bill in itself, it's named after a young girl who took her own life because of the bullying and the online harassment, and her mum really took on this and you know,
fair play to her.
you know drove so much of the change, and you know, it was the first bill I passed actually because I saw it like that and thought this is something that has to be done. But
it's just one piece,
there's so many other things that
are I don't know about a bill in general. Yeah. Like, for a bill like that, there'd probably be no objections to something like that. But, you know, if you want to get a bill passed, like, what's the process? Like, do you get your own party to back you and then you bring it to the coalition and try to get, like, how does it work?
Do you know, it's a mixture. So that bill in particular, these changes would have been recommendations from the Law Reform Commission a number of years ago. So they would have said this should be done. And that being said doesn't necessarily mean something's going to happen. But a colleague of mine, Brendan Howland, who is in the Labour Party, so, you know, it just shows there's always cross-party work as well on these kind of things, put forward a private members, so that's where non-government can put forward a bill and try to bring it forward. So I took the bill on as a government bill, developed it further, changed it and amended it and looked at kind of what we needed to do to make sure it worked as best as could, you know, took on what victims and their families were saying, and then you bring it into the houses. You have the Oireachtas and the Seanad, you have to go through committee stage, so you give people in the Justice Committee a chance to scrutinise it, to make recommendations, they come back, you can make changes to it. So, you know, it's never a quick process because you have to go through all of these.
How long, like, from start to finish with something like that?
So when I came in June that year, I took that bill on in July and we'd have passed by December, but that was relatively quick.
It was very quick.
I wish all bills would go that fast.
I was thinking that it might have taken a few years, and I was saying, I was going through my head, I was saying, Jesus, that took more than 12 months. I can imagine the amount of people in that 12 months may have been affected.
Yeah.
Well, it depends. At the moment, related to domestic violence, I'm bringing forward a bill that will establish a new agency, and their sole focus will be domestic violence, sexual violence. They'll be dealing with the refuge and accommodation. They'll be dealing with all the organisations. They'll be doing public campaigns, awareness. They'll be gathering data. And we would have announced as part of the Zero Tolerance, which is the whole of government plan to deal with domestic and sexual violence, that this agency was going to be set up, and that was last June. So from last June to now, I'm now bringing that bill into the houses. So it'll go through the different stages, and the plan is to have it enacted by the end of the year. So that's a year and a half kind of from this is what we're going to do to this is it being done.
Yeah.
But it varies, you know, and you know, this is something, again, that has full support, where you have legislation that's a bit more controversial, where it takes a bit of time. You often have to do engagement, public consultations, and it can take years. And that's often what frustrates people, that it's not a quick fix or legislation. So where you can change things through policy, where you can change things through programmes or investing money, you know, that's often a quicker way to do it. But sometimes you do need the law. On your
you
side as well.
Public consultation, the Citizens Assembly on Drugs is ongoing at the moment.
If you were
the Taoiseach, if you could implement your own policy off and again, what would it look like? Like, would you have like a decriminalisation of drugs? Would you have decriminalisation for small amounts? Would you have a legalisation, a Dutch model or a Portuguese model or scan? Like, where would you look for influence, or what's your idea?
Personally, I mean, I don't fully know what the picture should look like, because talking about what we've just talked about, I mean, I think there should be a health-led approach for a lot of people, because a lot of it is addiction. A lot of it is what causes so many of the problems that we have. There's another side of things where, you know, it's a social outlet and people take it on weekends and don't seem to think it's a problem and everything else. But then behind all of that, what's feeding us? And, you know, from the justice side, when I look at, you know, communities, it impacts the devastation it causes elsewhere. Communities destroyed, criminal gangs that are peddling all of this. Like, there has to be that balance there. I mean, the Citizens Assembly is doing its work at the moment. We've had two or three, and, you know,
Sheila was up there with a few of her lads.
Yeah, there was 2 weeks ago, you had a lot of the organisations who are dealing with younger people, dealing with people who have had addiction problems, were there to kind of explain, well, this is our understanding of it. But you had the guards as well coming at the different angle, saying, well, we have to deal with the repercussions of this day in, day out, and the devastation for communities. So, I mean, I think openly legalising it, it's not like fully, like, it's not the approach, I think. But there's possible variations of, you know, trying to have a different approach if somebody's caught, if somebody has an addiction, that it's not just seen as, we'll lock them up and throw away the key. Well, what else can we do here? How can we help people get out of this addiction? How can we help people look at a different path? And I think that's kind of more the direction that we need to be going in. But, you know, I think the Citizens Assembly, like, you think of the issue of the Eighth Amendment, abortion, really, really difficult.
That's a tough one to get through.
That, well, you know, the Citizens Assembly looks at things in a different way. And, you know, it's not to say that every recommendation is something that has to be taken aboard, but it gives me and it gives colleagues and it gives everybody kind of in the country who'll be looking at this a chance to actually analyse, well, what have people said here and what might work and what won't. And as you say, it's good to look at other countries and where things work and where they don't. I mean, fully legalising in some countries, we're now in a situation where they're pulling back, and where they said it hasn't worked, it's actually left things more difficult. So we have to be, we have to take that on board as well.
In Colorado, for example, legalising it was seen like a liberal move and stuff like that, but now you have edibles, the marketing of it, like big pharma, or the big companies then get behind it, and that was a big problem. But we had a podcast guest a few months ago, and remotely, she was a judge in Broward County in Florida, which is a big area. And she set up the United States' first mental health court. And it's for people who commit crime, petty crime. No, there wouldn't be felony charges. It's not like district court level crime, but they have a mental illness. And instead of, I says to her, like, what's the experience of the person that comes into the court? She says, it's like regular court, but the opposite. She says, when they stand before me, I ask them, how are they? Have they been treated well? And that's how we start. And like they'll be psychiatric reports, doctor's reports, stuff like that. But in Ireland, they'll go to prison. But in that area, they'll get the community supports. But we don't, even if you wanted to do that in the morning, we don't really have the community mental health supports in lieu of the prison. And a lot of the times, the judges are in a situation where this person committed a crime. I know they're not well, but I don't really know where else to put them.
Yeah. And it goes back to the what other alternatives are there. There's been a huge amount of investment in mental health services in years. We need more. Yeah. Like it's like a lot
constantly
of things.
Constantly catching
up. You're starting from such a low base, and like even our first part of the conversation around dad, and you know, people didn't even talk about it until recently. They didn't want to talk about it. People who were experiencing problems didn't, and it's just meant that the services were never there because people never sought help. So it's not an excuse, and it sounds like I'm making an excuse. You're starting from such a low base. You're trying to just build up and look at, well, what actually do we need? And you often need cross teams working together where there's, like, you know, we have a situation where if somebody has a mental health problem but also a drug and addiction problem, and one comes with the other, often they can't be treated because it's a dual diagnosis here. And it's only now we're actually putting structures in place where you have people that can deal with both at the same time. But that's only recently, and that's only come about because we're talking about it. We know it's a problem. We know it's something that can be fixed, but it needs that kind of sustained investment. And like that's happening, but it's just not, you know, it's not happening at the pace that we need it to, because there's a lot of people impacted by it, you know.
In the community that I come from, and James living in a different area at the moment, we have a massive issue with young people getting involved in drugs at a young age and racking up massive drug debts. And there's people coming around mother and father's doors looking for large quantities of money, you know, and there's a lot of young people taking their own lives over. And there's mothers and fathers having to rob, borrow, do whatever it takes to be able to get this money together and to help. Like, I've been watching in the area for the last few years, and like the community is absolutely devastated from it. And it's actually after happening within my own kind of circle as well. And I've been looking at it, you know, and I could be hypocritical because I was involved in drug trade years ago as well. And, you know, but I like to think that I would have never gave drugs to a young person, you know, even though that's ridiculous, that form of thinking as well. But what's happening today is just people are lost. People are genuinely lost because most of the people living in the community are just working class people who are just getting by on a week to week from whatever wage pack they have. And like, their lives are under threat, their homes are under threat, they're looking at their children who they think they're going to take their own lives because of what's going on, or they're going to be murdered or killed or whatever. And what's been done? Like, what's been done for people like this? Because these are good people, like, you know, whose kids are so young that they don't genuinely know what they're getting involved in, and they're not able to deal with the stress and the anxiety of these big debts and the threats, because they're not able, they don't understand it. Like, they're not somebody who's kind of worked their way into a position of selling the small quantities and working up into the bigger, the larger. These are kids who get large quantities at a young age.
And
they don't know what they're doing.
And I mean, this is a case that young people are being, they're being targeted and they're being groomed, and they're being shown this wonderful life, and you'll have all these wonderful things, but this is where it ends. It ends in what you've just described, or prison, or worse. And like, it's something I've been working on. So we have, again, it's a bill, but sometimes you need to change the law to make changes, and it's around grooming of children, and it's very specific to anybody who would target or bring a child into that life and groom them into criminality. And the bill itself looks at that, but it can be often difficult because you often have scenarios where people don't want to come forward, they don't want to go to the guards, they're afraid. So we have a number of pilots actually going on at the moment, and we've been working closely with the University in Limerick, looking at these type of scenarios where you have really hard to reach children, and often families that are in that scenario that don't want to come forward, where you have certain areas where gangs are very much taking a hold. Now, I mean, the work the guards do first and foremost is the most important there, and actually taking these guys off the street and preventing them from even being able to cause the misery that they do. But there's pilot programs happening at the moment where there's an intense focus on these type of young people. What will work, what won't work, what kind of more stress, you know, we have our youth diversion programs, we have programs in
there's
schools,
no position
you have different
in,
things
Cork
going on,
and Kerry.
What more needs to be done, because there are some really, really hard to reach. They don't fit into any of the programs that are there. And that's going on. It's called Greentown. And
it's a really
Sean Redmond's report. That was Dr. Sean Redmond did the Greentown report.
Yeah.
But there was a position created in Cork and Kerry through the task force, and it was specifically a worker specifically for drug-related intimidation. So that's just for people that's listening that might be affected by it. I'm sure there's an equivalent in their location too.
Yeah.
But there, like, stuff like that is you know, is what's needed. You know, a designated person, because it is.
And that was part of the safety plan that we launched on Friday in the inner city. One of the people that we've already funded for that plan is someone dealing with drug intimidation and death within communities. I'm not sure if they've been fully hired, but the fund is there to hire that person, because the community said we need somebody to deal with this problem. So there's all of those, and it comes back to communities going, right, what's the problem, what do we need? You know, I suppose we're doing our work in the department, and I'm doing it as minister, saying, well, where can we change the laws, how can we provide different resources, how can we put programs in place? But sometimes it's the community saying, okay, well, that's not working, we need something different. And what you're saying, I think it's something like that that needs to be put in place for this area.
Yeah, definitely. And you said it there, sometimes families, they can't come forward because the threat will be even wider, because they have to live in this community still.
Yeah.
Because they can't move over to that house, because that's the only roof they have over their heads.
Yeah.
And they can't go to the guards, or they can't make it public or whatever. And sometimes all they need really is a way of maybe setting up some form of payment plan, even some structure around that. Because they have no way out of it, really, you know, because they're living in this community and they can't say nothing, because there's a consequence.
You always have to help. You always have to try and find that way out.
It's about finding solutions and being able to work with this. And also another side of it is the young people trying to figure out a way that they'll actually understand, like, the damage that they're doing to their mothers and their fathers and themselves and their families in general, and it's trying to resolve that as well, because
when you're that young, it's
mad.
You don't get the concept of consequences, you see. It's just all in the moment. Well, listen, we covered a lot of ground there. Thank you for your time, Minister.
Not at all. It's great to talk to you guys. Yeah.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you very much. We'll cross paths again, I'm sure.
We will, absolutely. Yeah, it won't take so long the next time.
Thanks for your time. God bless.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
The Two Norries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.